am I wasting all this time reading all these other authors? There are so many more Sowell books to read. Let me just finish reading all the 47 Sowell books. I feel like the society would be a much better place if people simply considered his ideas and thought about them. No one's tuning into the Genius of Alan Wolin podcast. They're tuning into because I'm talking about Sowell's ideas. That's it.
I don't always agree with Thomas Sowell, but I find his line of reasoning enlightening.
Agreeing with Sowell is the booby prize. I don't necessarily agree with everything Sowell says either, but I always agree with his intellectual method. Because he's got not only intellect, he's got wisdom. And that's what I think people really relate to about Thomas Sowell on such a gut level, the deep wisdom of the man.
Welcome to episode 13 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin. In this episode, I feature an interview with one of Thomas Sowell's most committed and passionate students. I'm talking about myself, of course. I was recently invited to come on the Saving Elephants podcast to discuss Sowell's work, and this episode features that conversation. Saving Elephants is the podcast hosted by Josh Lewis, a Tulsa, Oklahoma-based accountant and podcaster. Saving Elephants is a podcast dedicated to reigniting conservatism among the millennial generation. And Josh discusses all the great thinkers of the conservative movement, from Edmund Burke to Thomas Paine to Roger Scruton to William F. Buckley Jr. to Thomas Sowell and many, many others. Josh and I had a great conversation about Sowell and his ideas. I was honored to be the featured guest of Josh's 100th podcast episode. Given that this is only our 13th episode, I know how much work it is to produce 100 episodes. Here's my conversation with Josh.
Alan, thank you for taking the time to come on with me and reflecting on the genius of Thomas Sowell. I was first introduced to Sowell. I probably had heard his name before and was loosely familiar with him, but I never really truly had an introduction to him until I was in college. And I was in a class called The American Idea of Character that was charting a historical view of the different ways in which the United States viewed morality. And about halfway through the course, the professor turned to the issue of race relations and spent the remainder of the semester on that, introduced us to a wide variety of arguments from both the left and the right, and I'm eternally grateful. But the one that stuck out to me the most was Thomas Sowell, and specifically the introductory essay in his book, the title of the book, Black Rednecks and White Liberals, possibly the most provocative of Sowell's titles, just immediately grabbed my attention. And the way this guy argued, I had never previously encountered anything like this before. And I was like, wow, this is not only in depth, but it's easy to understand. And it's introducing information to me that I had never previously considered. And I was both overwhelmed and intrigued to me, like, who is this guy? I wanted to learn more. But I want to start here because you obviously have devoted an inordinate amount of effort and energy into your research and your podcast. How were you introduced to Tom Sowell? And if it is different, how did you become a fan of Tom Sowell?
I discovered Thomas Sowell totally by accident. I was in a Barnes & Noble bookstore in New York City where I lived at the time. And there was a table with a bunch of random books on it. And, you know, you pick them up, you put them down, you pick them up, you put them down. And I picked up one called Economic Facts and Fallacies. And I'm someone that's been interested in economics for a long time. I have a master's in business administration, so I studied some economics. And I picked up this book, and I had never heard of the author, Thomas Sowell. There was no picture of him on the book. It was a very dry looking book that, you know, you could tell it was not designed by the marketing department of the publisher. It was designed by probably Thomas Sowell himself. And I just started reading it. And I ended up buying the book and was completely smitten by the ideas in the book. And he talked about common economic beliefs and why they were fallacies. And that launched me on a tear of reading one Sowell book after the other. And every one I read was, I experienced it as a mind-blowing, paradigm-shifting experience. And I've been hooked ever since. And I decided to do this podcast because I was doing a lot of reading over the past couple of years. I think in about a year and a half, I read about 100 books. And I remember after reading, one of them was a Sowell book. And I said, why am I wasting all this time reading all these other authors? There are so many more Sowell books to read. Let me just finish reading all the 47 Sowell books. So I said to myself, I don't want to read these by myself. How can I bring other people into the conversation? I know I'll start a podcast. So that was what I did. And I decided to just devote a few years to reading and studying really Thomas Sowell's writings. And I quickly realized that the best way to read these books is to be forced to summarize them for other people. And that's what the podcast has done for me. You know, you could tear through a Thomas Sowell book, but when you know you have to explain it to other people and summarize it and talk about it, you read in a different way, a much deeper way. And I've been really enjoying that. That's sort of the story of the podcast. And it's been a real adventure. I've been meeting some amazing people and having them on the show and just having debates about Sowell's ideas. I'm not looking for a bunch of fanboys to come on the show and agree with everything Sowell writes. My goal is really to get more people talking about Sowell's ideas. I feel like the society would be a much better place if people simply considered his ideas and thought about them and debated them and discussed them. And I think I'm accomplishing that goal with this podcast. It's been great. I'm getting, you know, fan emails from all over the world, people saying, thank you so much for doing this. I've always loved Thomas Sowell. And when is the next episode coming out? And, you know, it really motivates me knowing, you know, that I have thousands and thousands of listeners to each episode. They don't want to hear what I have to say. You know, no one's tuning into the Genius of Alan Wolin podcast. They're tuning into because I'm talking about Sowell's ideas. That's it. That's all I really want to do with this podcast is just talk about his ideas and hear what other people think about them.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I feel oftentimes I have a similar role in Saving Elephants. Now, I have a broader, I think I had mentioned, you know, the Mount Rushmore of Edmund Burke, Russell Kirk, William F. Buckley, and Thomas Sowell. And honestly, I've written a blog post of 50 conservative thinkers. So it's much more than those four. But I feel like most of the time at my best, all I'm really doing is regurgitating and summarizing ideas from these geniuses. And I don't, you know, you mentioned not that you want just fanboys for Sowell. Like, I don't always agree with Thomas Sowell, but I find his line of reasoning enlightening. The way he approaches things is with such depth and clarity and such a disinterest in ideological entanglement, shall we say, that he's trying to prove out some sort of an idea that he has in his head as to how the world ought to work. He's disinterested in that, right? It's like, no, how does the world actually work? And if that challenges my prejudices, you know, then let's go there. Let's consider these things. What he would get from, say, the Chicago school or his experience there that he really grafted onto this. I want to be careful using the word empiricism because I know that's also a philosophical school, and I don't think Sowell is a strict empiricist in that sense. And maybe I can open this up to you, Alan. What is Sowell's general approach when it comes to empiricism and evaluating evidence against popular hypotheses, say?
Well, I think the point that you were just making was that, you know, when you say you don't always agree with everything he says, I think that in a way, agreeing with Sowell is the booby prize. I don't think that's really the goal. And I think the goal is, you see, what I don't necessarily agree with everything Sowell says either, but I always agree with his intellectual method, which is to look at the facts and be open to alternative explanations for the facts and be open to the possibility that things don't always work out the way you think they ought to. And I always agree with that. And if Sowell supports a particular political candidate, I might not support that candidate or vice versa. And I don't think that's important. And if he gives a lot of weight to a particular issue, like I remember when Sowell was really, all he could talk about was Iran, what a big threat they were. I didn't necessarily see it the same way, but I always said to myself, I wonder what his reasons are for thinking about it that way. That really interests me. Someone that I admire so deeply is so focused on that. There must be something to it that I'm not seeing. So I would always give him the benefit of the doubt and just open my mind up to what he saw that I didn't see. Because he's got not only intellect, he's got wisdom. Mm-hmm. He's got, you know, intellect without experience can be a little bit stale. But when you combine intellect with his decades and decades of experience, that really morphs into wisdom. And that's what I think people really relate to about Thomas Sowell on such a gut level, the deep wisdom of the man that goes way beyond mere intellect.
Yeah. Decades and decades. We should probably mention, if the listener was unaware, he was born in 1930. So he's what, 92, or will soon be 92. He's still writing, from what I understand, in the I believe it's the definitive biography Maverick by Jason Riley. He mentioned that he was born in 1930 to a family with no electricity, no running hot water. His father died before he's born. His mother died as a maid, passed away giving birth to his younger brother of a few years. So really, in a lot of ways, born in an impoverished, tragic setting. And if I'm not mistaken, he didn't publish his first book. You mentioned earlier 47 books, but the first one I don't think was published until he was in his 40s or pretty late in life. Like I know he wrote for the next five decades and he's still writing. He's not slowing down, but his output is insane and runs rings around so many other, you know, that in a lot of ways he started this amazing intellectual pursuit and career when most of us are kind of going through our midlife.
The other great thing about Sowell is that he's not a one-trick pony. You know, a lot of black intellectuals have, you know, focused on the issue of race.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what I love about Sowell's work actually has nothing to do with race. His books on political theory, his books on economics, his books on knowledge, his books on decision making. I mean, this guy is a real polymath in the true sense of the word, because he deals with so many important subjects. And race, yes, it's one of them, but it's really just one of many. It's not even the main one. And you can't say that about a lot of other people. How many people have written about the breadth of subjects that he tackles? Almost nobody, actually.
Yeah.
I can't think of anybody now, you know, alive today. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I think some might argue, I've heard comparisons between Thomas Sowell and Roger Scruton in terms of breadth and depth. But unfortunately, Scruton passed last year. But yeah, it would be a very small group that have written that in depth and broadly. One of which you mentioned political theory. One of his earlier landmark books, of course, A Conflict of Visions, which is interesting. Now, if I had a, say, leftist or progressive, or I'll just say non-conservative mindset, it would be an interesting thought experiment if I could read through that book and feel that it is as even-handed as I do from my biased on the right point of view, say. But one of the things I find interesting about A Conflict of Vision is that, unlike some of his later works, he appears to be, I don't want to say trying to argue in good faith for both sides, because I think he always does that, but he appears to try to be taking a balanced view, say, of both the broadly speaking right and left. And what measure I just express, what he refers to as the constrained and the unconstrained visions, that he talks about how reality is actually far too complex for us to understand a totality. And so therefore we humans in our limited states are dependent upon visions. What I would typically call like a worldview, say. Now, he deduces these into two broad ones in the West, the constrained and the unconstrained vision. And if I remember correctly, I think I heard in one of your podcasts, Alan, you don't particularly like those terms, or you say he uses other terms elsewhere. Is that true? And if so, what were the other terms he uses for these two broad divisions?
Yeah, if you read A Conflict of Visions, he talks about the constrained and the unconstrained visions. And I think it's not a great terminology, because the mind just sort of hears them as one word, like constrained. Yeah. Just sounds like unconstrained.
Yeah.
And in one of my podcasts, I joke that it reminds me of the George Carlin routine about the word flammable and inflammable, you know, both meaning the same thing, even though they sound a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And but in other books by Sowell, he uses for the constrained vision, he talks about the tragic vision. And for the unconstrained vision, he calls it the utopian vision. So I just find that a lot easier for the mind to wrap around, you know, the tragic versus the utopian vision. And the tragic vision, you know, just to summarize it, basically says that, you know, humans are flawed. We've always been flawed. We always will be flawed. And the best we can hope for is to devise social systems that keep our animalistic tendencies in check. And there'll always be crime. There'll always be war. There'll always be, you know, envy, lust, greed, sloth, you know, all the seven deadly sins, and that we just have to find ways to manage them. Whereas the utopian vision believes that man is infinitely perfectible, that we can be our best selves over time. If only social institutions were set up in just the right way, human beings would really behave in a perfect way. And it's our duty to constantly manipulate the social environment to bring out the best in the human beings. And these two visions have been, you know, clashing for hundreds of years. It's nothing new. And depending on which vision you ascribe to, it's going to determine how you see a lot of really important social issues. So in my podcast episode where I talked about a conflict of visions, I did an episode where I looked at a couple of songs from the new Steven Spielberg movie, West Side Story. And I talked about how they were a perfect expression of this conflict. One song that your listeners may remember is a song called G Officer Krupke, where these juvenile delinquents are standing in front of a judge, trying to explain to the judge that it's not their fault that they, you know, have led such criminal lives. It was all just a result of their poor upbringing in difficult circumstances, and that the judge should, you know, cut them a break, not punish them, and really in a way feel sorry for them as victims. And, this was, I thought, a great manifestation, a great expression of the conflict between those two visions that Sowell talks about in his book. And I think we could see that conflict playing out on just about every important issue of the day. So I think if you have to start with one Sowell book, A Conflict of Visions might be the best one to start with, because it lays out Sowell's vision for so many other things and so many other books that he writes.
Yeah, it's bedrock, not only to Thomas Sowell, but I would even argue, I think an individual that reads this could easily identify, okay, constrained, or as we're calling tragic, maps to certainly certain understandings of, say, a conservative worldview. I know conservatism, liberalism, progressivism, these are terms that get messy in a hurry. But I think we could generally understand, okay, this is a conservative worldview, whereas the unconstrained or the utopic vision would map to a progressive worldview, say, and that you can see certain, trace it all the way down to even economic policies springing from these basic ideas, and why it is that sometimes we Americans have a difficult time arguing with each other about policy when underlying the policy are warring or conflicting, as Sowell says, conflicting visions of reality, and how those things inform how we think about the outcome of policy.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that Sowell does, he avoids, you know, using the language conservative versus liberal or conservative versus progressive. He tries right. not to, you know, become obsessed with that. But it's hard to read that book as a conservative and not think aha, this explains the difference between conservatives and liberals. This pretty much lays it all out, because it does seem to be the divide.
Yes, and it is a taken from maybe a tragic or constrained idea. This does seem to be a divide that is in a certain sense almost inherent in human nature. And this may be something that, I don't know, maybe Alan or maybe you or maybe even Thomas would disagree with, but I think there's a certain degree of which these broader conservative / progressive visions that underlie our policies are somewhat innate in human nature, that we he even talks about in conflict of vision that data or facts can maybe bolster a vision, but they don't, none of them can ultimately destroy the vision, that the vision is a priori, say to our other policy debates, and that there is a certain sense in which we are, you mentioned hundreds of years. I think for hundreds of years in the future, there is going to be this basic conflict between the tragic and the utopic vision.
So what are we going to do about it, Josh? I mean, how are we going to solve this problem? Are we going to be fighting for the rest of eternity, if not longer?
No, and that's it. Look, here's the thing. One of my underlying beliefs is I think there are healthier expressions of both a conservative and a progressive mindset. If you boil it down to its absolute essence, that and I know it's far more complex than this, but there is a sense of which I think conservatism, if it's a sense of gratitude of trying to maintain that which we have, and progressivism being a sense of a desire for justice or moving the ball forward in some sense, that in any thriving virtuous society, you have to have certain elements of both of those things. I think you can also have very unhealthy expressions of both of these. And I do think that we live in a time and an era, and have for the past several hundred years, in which our true danger is speed. It's development. It's an unwillingness to sort of hold to the good of the past. And so this is an era in which I think conservatism needs to be expressed more forcefully, shall we say. And again, I have a constrained vision. So I don't know. Argument is not bad. I'm not afraid of argument. But the particular type of argument we have these days seems very unhealthy and dangerous.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Serena and Tina, hosts of No Need to Explain with the Mental Health Mamas.
We are parents with lived experience who are on a mission to normalize the conversation around mental health.
Join us as we share a bit of what we've learned along the way, help you feel less alone, and remind you to take care of yourself while also taking care of your people.
We elevate the voices of others on such topics as the art of holding space, parenting with PTSD, first responder mental health, and more.
You'll find our podcast on our website, noneedtoexplainpodcast.com, or wherever you're listening right now.
With the Mental Health Mamas, there is no need to explain.
Well, I don't know what to say to that exactly, but I just, I always come back to when things get confusing, it really helps me to read Thomas Sowell books, because I feel like he has a way of breaking down the problem in a way that almost no one else does. So let me give you an example. I was just reading Discrimination and Disparities, Chapter 3. I'm doing a podcast about Chapter 3 of Discrimination and Disparities. And the title of the – have you read this book, Josh?
I have not had a chance to read that
one. Okay. Okay, great. So I'll send you this chapter. I think it's worth reading. It's pretty short. It's only 25 pages. And I'll put a link to the chapter in the show notes of my upcoming podcast. I just got off the phone with Charles Love talking about this chapter. And the chapter starts off with the title Sorting and Unsorting People. It really struck me, just the title of the chapter, because of all the things I do with other people, I don't usually think of myself as sorting and unsorting them. But after Sowell explained what he meant by that, I realized that's pretty much most of what we do with other people, is we sort them and we unsort them. And we're always doing it. People in all cultures do it. And they do it for a reason. Men use one locker room and women use another locker room. That's a form of sorting. There's a reason that good students go to one school and not so good students go to a different school. That's another form of sorting. Sowell gives an example. Once you hear this example, you can never forget it. He calls it sorting and labeling. So he said, imagine a flood washes into a supermarket, washes off all the labels off the cans. So all the cans are just sitting there and there's no labels on them. You know, how much would those cans be worth without the labels on it? If you didn't know which one was the peas and which one was the corn and which one was the, almond paste, you know, how much would you pay for a can? Mm-hmm. And the truth is not very much. So there's a huge value in sorting and labeling people, just like there is in sorting and labeling cans. And in today's day and age, we think that all sorting of people is bad and we're doing our best to unsort them. Go back to the example I gave a minute ago. We're even trying to unsort the locker rooms. We're trying to, force people to live in neighborhoods that they wouldn't necessarily have chosen to live in. We're trying to unsort people where they go to school. And Sowell points out, he was talking in this book about Brown versus Board of Education, where the Supreme Court, ruled that it was unconstitutional to sort people by race when it came to schooling. And Sowell makes the very unconventional argument that this was a really bad development for Black students because it prevented them from being in Black-only schools. And there were quite a few very successful Black-only schools. And it forced them to be mixed in with white kids. And it didn't necessarily lead to higher educational accomplishments, which is a very Sowellian argument. You hear it and you go, wait a second, did he just say that Brown versus Board of Education was not a good thing for the Black students? I mean, did he say that? Like, what does he mean by that? It really makes you think. And that was one of the great things about Sowell, is that he could say things that are extremely counterintuitive. Another example of that is in his essay about slavery, what he calls the real history of slavery. And he makes the argument that Western society was actually the first and only society to have a moral issue with slavery, while every other society in the world saw no problem with it and actually resisted the abolition of it. So not only can you not blame Western society for slavery, you actually have to credit Western society for having the guts to abolish it, which is the exact argument that a lot of people are making today, which is that it's a great shame of Western society that it tolerated slavery for as long as it did. And Sowell makes the exact opposite argument, which is that the history of slavery is actually a great credit on the ledger of Western society, that it had the vision to abolish it. So Sowell makes these very counterintuitive arguments that are really paradigm shifting for the reader. They really, in a way, rewire your brain mm-hmm. to look at, very important issues in a very, very fresh way. And I literally cannot read a single essay by Thomas Sowell without viewing the problem in a totally different way.
So the essay, the Real History of Slavery, you had an entire episode, of course, in which you, and I thought this was very interesting, that you broke down his essential arguments there, but then you invited on two scholars, Wilfred Riley and Charles Boyd, to debate that issue, right? To not simply, as we're saying kind of at the beginning of this conversation, to not just agree with everything Sowell says, but to dig in and say, okay, well, here's the argument Sowell's laying out. And I would agree with you. I think if the average American read Sowell's essay, The Real History of Slavery, I think they would walk away, whether or not it made them angry or they felt inclined to agree with it. I think the average American would walk away with a sense of, I've never thought about it that way before, right? It's a little unique approach. But what was your general takeaway? Because I thought it was interesting between the debate between Riley and Boyd. For the most part, they seem to agree on a great many things. And I don't want to just say they were disagreeing on the margins. I think they had more substantive disagreement than that. But I did seem to walk away from that podcast with a, say, slightly more balanced view than just a complete Sowellian, we have to credit the West. Although I think in a sense what Sowell is almost doing is he's running against the grain of conventional wisdom that slavery is a uniquely Western or maybe a uniquely American problem from which we have, understandably, a lot of shame and guilt on our hands. But that he's almost running against that grain to say, well, if you put it into perspective, that's not telling the whole story by just focusing on what went wrong in the United States or in Western civilization. But what was your takeaway from not only reading and studying Sowell's The Real History of Slavery, but that interaction between Riley and Boyd?
You know, I think that, Will Riley kept coming back to, but Boyd would give a bunch of objections to the way Sowell laid things out. And he would poke holes in Sowell's description of the history, take issue with certain facts that Sowell named. And Riley would respond by saying, well, I can't really comment on those points, but I think that Thomas Sowell gets it basically right when he says that Western society was the first and only society to seek to abolish slavery, and that it should get credit for that. And he kept coming back to that, no matter how many holes Boyd would poke in Sowell's essay. Mm-hmm. Riley would always come back to, I think Sowell gets it basically right. And my own feedback is Riley was right about that, that he sort of, in my mind, sort of won the debate. And I've gotten a lot of email from listeners also saying that, the same thing, that they understood Boyd's points, but they feel like it wasn't really the point of the debate, was to, try to see if Sowell's points were historically 100% unquestionable. The point was really, does Sowell get it basically right? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you look at Sowell's, essay, it is a paradigm shifting essay, because it's not a point of view that you hear very often, that, slavery was abolished by these Western nations against the resistance of all other non-Western nations. And that you once you hear that argument and you let it sink in, I think you can never again look at the slavery issue the same way. There are certain things in life, once you see them, you cannot unsee them again. And I think that's one of them. I think that's one of those issues where once you hear the presentation of the history of slavery, and I've never heard anybody, dispute Sowell's version of the history of slavery in general. Like, mm-hmm. I've heard, they could pick a couple of points, did Jefferson really say this, or did, Madison really say that, or whatever. But the broad stroke picture of the history of slavery that Sowell presents, I've never heard anybody dispute that. But it's not one that we often hear. And it's not one that most people know about. If I were to do man on the street interviews and tell me, when do you think slavery started and where, I bet you, 99 of 100 people would say, in America in, 1619 or something like that. And they don't know what happened for, thousands of years before that.
Sowell's contention, of course, is that slavery was an institution practiced universally for millennia.
Yeah, and that no one had a problem with it. Even enslaved people, when they became free, would often enslave others. They thought that was just the natural course of things, that whoever was stronger dominated whoever was weaker. And no one seemed to have a big problem with that. And everybody thought that was the way it had to be.
I do think it needs to be said, just because of the obvious sensitivity around this issue, that I don't read from Sowell that he's in any way absolving, nor in reading Sowell do I think we're in any way absolving the sins of America's past in terms of slavery. I think he's offering that needs to be considered in addition to the fact that Western civilization is responsible for abolishing the institution of slavery.
stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you sick of all those social media influencers telling you about all the money you could and should be making by investing in real estate? Well, we are two of those guys, but we're out here actually doing it and not just posting on Instagram. If you want to know how a real estate investing business works, one where we are regularly buying properties at huge discounts and creating generational wealth while also creating enough passive cash flow to not have to work a W-2 job, then you need to check out the Collecting Keys podcast with me, Mike DeHaan, and my co-host, Dan Austin. We tell the truth about running a full-time real estate investing business without any of the fluff, so you know what it really takes to make a fortune in real estate. So check out the Collecting Keys podcast, 30-minute episodes every Wednesday on either YouTube or anywhere you download your podcast.
Well, you know, even the term sins of the past, I think, needs to be unpacked a little bit, because one of the things that I get out of reading Sowell is a deep appreciation for not judging past generations using today's standards. It's very easy to do that, you know, to look back on human history and say, oh, those people were evil, those people were wrong. And it's so obvious, they had to have known that what they were doing was wrong. And I just don't think that that holds up under scrutiny. I don't think they had to know what they were doing was wrong. And I don't even think they could have known what they were doing was wrong, because there was really no history of seeing things then the way we see things now. You know, the mental, here's the mental, the thought experiment that I always do. I try to imagine, you know, 200 years into the future, let's imagine that everybody's vegetarian. Everybody's vegan. And there's a general belief that eating animals is morally wrong, and that keeping pets is morally wrong. It's a form of slavery to enslave pets, to actually put them in chains and keep them at your will. And that's the general belief in 200 years. Now, will people then look back on dog and cat owners with a sense of moral superiority? Probably. Would they look back on people who ate meat and think they were barbarians and almost cannibals? Maybe. But will their view that we should have known better and we could have known better, would that be true? I don't think so. You know, I think when you grow up in a world of you know, meat eating and pet owning, you, as from when you were a little child, you don't question it. It just seems normal to you. And I think that that moral relativism is something that I think that you get by reading Sowell. You know, you have an appreciation for the past and your inability to judge across centuries, past generations, is really a form of intellectual hubris. That's what I get anyway. How do you see it, Josh?
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking this through, because this is a, and I may not have enough caffeine in my system to give a thoughtful response, because I'm not certain that I fully agree with what you're saying there. But let me try to dice through it a little bit. I do agree with, you know, the individual who introduced me to the concept of a moral hubris. I think the term they coined was chronological snobbery, was C.S. Lewis. There's a sort of notion that the things of the past are barbaric and that we're civilized today, and therefore we can look down at the past. And so I have no quarrel at all with the general idea, and I do appreciate this in Thomas Sowell's approach, that he tries to, you know, I think the phrase I've heard before is grade racism on a curve. He tries to understand within a historical construct what would have been considered moral or immoral at that time. And that is very easy, obviously, for us to look back. I know that Jordan Peterson, for example, talks about, if you were born in Germany and came of age circa 1930, would you have been a member of the Nazi Party, or would you have had the moral scruples to recognize the evil inherent in that? So I take the point that there is a danger in, say, judging the past based on the morals of today. To me, my main takeaway from that, obviously, is to be aware of the limited view we as humans have, thinking wow, are there things that I just take for granted today that actually are immoral that I should be more cognizant of, that just because the time period I live in says it's okay doesn't make it okay? That being said, I don't at all get from Thomas Sowell, I guess this is the part that I, if I'm understanding you correctly, would disagree. I don't at all get from Thomas Sowell that there is a sort of historicism or a moral relativism in an exhaustive sense. In other words, I don't think that Thomas Sowell is arguing that slavery is okay if everyone else thinks it's okay, or that these moral evils somehow change based on the calendar. I think it's more or less he's presenting us with a view that allows us to put to properly evaluate what individuals would have been thinking in those time periods before we sort of say pass moral judgment on them. It doesn't absolve the, shall we say, sins of the past, but it might inform how we would think of individuals who are in those circumstances. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I don't think we're disagreeing. Let me give another example. And then, one thing I learned from Sowell was that when we, in the year 2022, look back at monarchies where the king would pass on his rule to his son. And we in a democratic republic look at that and go, my God, what were people thinking that they thought that was a good idea, right? But Sowell would say is, well, we compare that now to a democratic republic, but that wasn't an option at the time. What they compared that system to was when the king would die, the generals would amass their armies and fight each other and kill each other over who would be the next king. And there was a lot of bloodshed in that system. So the idea of passing it on from a father to his son seemed like an upgrade from the system of generals fighting with their armies for control over the nation. And you have to judge the monarchical system and compare it with the alternative that was available at the time, and not to a utopian alternative that no one had thought of yet. So I think that while we have private property, and while we have capitalist system, and we have all these other a constitutional republic, we have all these other features that we can now compare everything to, not every past generation had those. And they didn't necessarily have it as an option. It wasn't on the menu. And they had to choose from what was on the menu. And I think that's sort of where I feel like I've learned a lot from Sowell, was that we cannot always compare past generations to the options that we have now. That we have to think about what options they had available to them at the time.
I guess generally speaking, I would agree with that. And as I mentioned earlier, C.S. Lewis and chronological snobbery, one of his insights that I gained from him is that he talked about how there are certain aspects of human existence that are progressive in nature and others that are not. He used the example of technology, of scientific advancement, that it tends to be progressive in nature, that we are by almost any measurement more progressed in science than we were, say, several thousand years ago, or heck, even 10 years ago or 100 years ago. Other aspects of human existence are not. Culture, religion, morality, these can wax and wane. And this, of course, is maybe going back to Thomas Sowell's idea of the constrained or the tragic vision, that we as human beings are the same today as we were 1,000 years ago in some sense. That one of the dangers, therefore, is to presume that because we have progressed and civilized, that our ancients or the medieval era has nothing of value to share for us. That because they were, knuckle dragon Neanderthals that lived in monarchies, that there's no reason for us to pay attention to what they believed at that time. When in reality, we do that to our peril because we are blinded by the particular era we live in, and there may be things of immense value they could teach us.
100%. I mean, one could even make the argument that we haven't really progressed morally.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Aubrey, and we're the hosts of the All Ears English podcast.
If you're an international professional or student and you want to feel more confident with your English,
Skills like presentations in business or small talk at the office.
Or even attending a dinner party in American culture.
We cover it all. Vocabulary, pronunciation, role plays.
We believe in connection, not perfection, when it comes to learning English.
Come learn with us.
Look for the All Ears English podcast and hit follow now.
That, and that's a complex, you know, I'm a poor theologian. I do wonder about that. I know there are multiple arguments there, like, is it even possible for humanity as a whole to progress morally? I'm kind of mixed on that opinion. Like, I think there are ways in which we could say, I think the Nazi culture, was evil. I don't have too much of a qualm of saying that. Other cultures, I think it's on balance. They're inherently logical. And so it's hard to compare. Well, what do we mean by moral or immoral, at times? But I think I would say this. I think if a human being is born today versus 1,000 years ago, it's the same basic material. We can have moral progress, but we start the clock over with every new generation, in a sense.
Right. Every new generation is born barbarians that need to be civilized.
Right.
That's what Sowell would say. I mean, you know, let me just step back for a second. Like, I don't think any of your listeners should really care about what I think. I don't think I've achieved any great accomplishments on the intellectual front. My role is really to channel Thomas Sowell and to bring his ideas to a wider audience. That is my goal. And that's why I started the podcast. And that's really what I want to do. I mean, I have my own personal life. I have a family. I have a career. I have children. I have, you know, all kinds of things going on. So that's really my main focus in life. But when it comes to the intellectual realm, what I have chosen to do is to really do a deep dive into the work of Thomas Sowell and to create a place where people can come and reflect on his ideas, talk about his ideas, debate his ideas, discuss his ideas. And I am not the authority on Thomas Sowell. I cannot make the claim that I understand his work better than other people, or that I am a sort of an authority on what he meant by this or what he meant by that. I don't actually think that. There could be a lot of people who understand his work better than me. And I would love to have them on the show to set me straight on certain topics. So nothing I've said up on this podcast so far should be taken as any kind of authority about what Thomas Sowell thinks about this or about that. And, you know, you are just as good a reader of Thomas Sowell as I am, even if you haven't read as many of his books as I have. It doesn't really, you know, you don't get brownie points for the quantity of Sowell you've consumed, you know. So I just, you know, encourage your reader, your listeners to pick up a Sowell book and dive into it. And I think I wouldn't be overselling it to say that your mind will be blown. Your paradigms will be shifted and your brain will be rewired, literally rewired in a more powerful way. And I don't think that's an exaggeration to say that. I find that every time I pick up a Sowell book, even if I just read a few pages, I learn something every single time. And Sowell also is an intellectual historian. So to read Sowell is to actually take a journey through the history of ideas. If you read A Conflict of Visions, he takes you on a tour of some of the greatest thinkers. A lot of the people that you focus on your podcast, he takes you on a tour of those thinkers, and he packages it for you so that you can understand it better. He gives you quotes. He gives you debates that they engaged in, and he contrasts them with other thinkers. And he really brings the history of ideas to light. That's what I studied in college. I was an intellectual history major. And that's, I think, explains why I became so fascinated with people like Sowell, because he was also an intellectual historian. It's one of the most important things you can study, because we always assume that the ideas that we have now in the year 2022, oh, these are the best ideas.
that mankind has come up with because they're the most recent. But when you actually look at the history of ideas and the history of philosophy, there's been a lot of ups and downs and a lot of progress and a lot of setbacks. And we're not necessarily more advanced in our thinking than people 100 or 200 or 300 years ago were.
I have this struggle with Thomas Sowell that I often do and do not want to refer to him as an intellectual. Because by certain definitions, Thomas Sowell is an intellectual and among one of the greats. But he doesn't necessarily write in very flattering ways about intellectuals. And so sometimes I wonder if it'd almost be an insult to give him that label. And I was wondering if we could turn to his overall views and concerns with intellects. I know that you had mentioned that, I think I've got this right, your favorite Thomas Sowell book is Intellectuals and Society.
Correct.
In which he has a pretty scathing review of intellectuals' effect on society. Could you give us a summary, if you would, of what was his basic argument there and what was his contention or problem with, say, air quotes, intellectuals?
Yeah, I mean, let me start by saying that you're right. Intellectuals and Society is my all-time favorite Sowell book. I just think it's the greatest. I just think it's the greatest. And I've read it, you know, at least three times, and I often refer to it. And Sowell makes the basic argument that intellectuals often get it completely wrong. Not just a little bit wrong, not just wrong on this or that subject, but often they get it completely and massively and disastrously wrong. And this is such a counterintuitive notion that when you first hear it, you're like, what the heck could he be talking about? The smartest people in the society get it completely wrong? What is he saying here? And he's, you know, the book is, I think, about 800 pages long. And he gives example after example after example of famous, well-known, respected intellectuals throughout history making the biggest mistakes and supporting disastrous policies. Let me give a good example of this. He okay. talks about intellectuals between World War I and World War II, how the vast majority of intellectuals turned to pacifism as the solution to the evils of war. They were very distraught over the destruction of World War I, and they said, we have to find a new way. We have to become a pacifist society. And they advocated policies of unilateral disarmament and of teaching the young about the evils of war. And their belief was that if they disarm people both mentally and militarily, if they disarm themselves mentally and militarily, that they will avoid war in the future. And what they didn't realize was that this disarmament on both a moral and a military level was exactly the opportunity that someone like a Hitler or a Mussolini was waiting for, because it emboldened them to think that a war would be winnable. So Sowell makes the argument that the idea of pacifism actually caused World War II, because the idea was so widespread in Western Europe that there was nobody to stand up to a bully like a Hitler or a Mussolini. So the idea is very counterintuitive. You probably can't meet a single person on the street who thinks that pacifism caused World War II. But Sowell makes the argument, and I think he makes a very convincing argument, and that the intellectuals, the smartest people of the time, just got it completely wrong. And he gives many other examples, the support of intellectuals for communism, for the Soviet Union, for a lot of things. And
Overpopulation.
And, you know, these were ideas that at the time, the smartest people believed in, and it just turned out to be completely wrong. And yet
they, for some reason, and he explains why, they don't seem to lose any diminution in their reputation or their status. No matter how many times they get it wrong, they stay on top and they're still considered the experts. And I think that once you read this book, it reframes how you listen to intellectuals forever. You can never again listen to an intellectual with the same nodding agreement that you used to once you read this book, because you realize that they lack a certain common sense. You know, and I think, and I, the analogy that I tried to draw in my episode about this book was the jury system. You know, we Americans are huge fans of the jury system. It's really hard to meet anybody. I tried. I went out to a cafe and I interviewed random people what they thought about the jury system. I didn't meet a single person who thought it should be abolished, who thought there was a better option than having random people from the street of all different education levels decide the fate of their fellow citizens. I couldn't find a single person that thought there was a better alternative to that. And I think that we understand that there's a wisdom and a common sense to the average person, and that intellectuals, you know, don't have that. I asked everybody, if you were on trial for a serious crime, would you prefer to have your fate decided by a jury of common people, or would you prefer a panel of highly educated elites? And every single person said a jury of common people. And I think that's what intellectuals in society is really about, is why do those smart people get it wrong so often? What are the incentives of being a public intellectual that leads them to make such preposterous determinations? And he explains that, and that's what he does in the book. And that's why it's my favorite book, because it reframes everything else I read after that book.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, listen, I know you think it may be impossible to have this, but you deserve your freedom, the ability to do what you want, when you want, with who you want, every single day. If that got your attention, then I just may be the voice for your next podcast binging experience. Hi, my name is Brian Lubin, and I am the host of the Action Academy podcast. I was able to hit financial independence and retire from corporate America for good at the age of 27. I did this only because of the help of my millionaire mentors, and that's what my show is. 5 days a week, I interview multimillionaire entrepreneurs and ask them the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps they took to earn their freedom. Let's earn yours back too. Talk soon.
Having not read those 800 pages myself, you may disagree with this, because my reading of Sowell's views on intellectuals come from some of his other writings. But my reading of Thomas Sowell is that he would not, strictly speaking, be a, say, anti-intellectual or against the idea of expertise or intellectualism, but rather he's highly critical in the directions and the misuse of the intellectual. And what I mean by that is he writes often about knowledge, that knowledge is one of the most sacred and precious resources, one of the rarest resources. And he talks about, well, in fact, I'll just quote him here in his book, Conflict Divisions, experts may indeed have far more knowledge than the average amount of knowledge among individuals in the general population, but the total amount of knowledge among millions of people in the general population vastly exceeds the total knowledge that any group of experts can assemble. And so I don't think Sowell is arguing, look, if you have heart problems, you need to take it, you know, to a vote of your peers, what should I do with my heart? But you go to your expert, right, your physician. But that most of what we encounter in society, from economics, from, as you were talking, the views on the period between World War I and World War II, that the knowledge in society, that the knowledge across economies is diffused among the broader population and is not in some sacred ivory tower of the intellect. Do you think that's a fair reading of Sowell's argument?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite Sowell quotes is this one that he says, a diamond is worth more than a penny, but enough pennies are worth more than any diamond. And I think that that's what you were getting at, which is that the vast majority of consequential knowledge, i.e. important knowledge, is widely distributed in the population, and it is not concentrated among a few intellectuals in this society. And I think that's the key point.
And there are, by necessity of our limitations within human institutions, certain things of which have to be decided by single individuals or by small groups, and we would hope that those would be the most knowledgeable among us. But many things, and I'm speaking here of Sowell's view, say, of the economy, he's an advocate of the free market system because that is a system that allows for each of us individuals to be making decisions rather than for a central control committee, say, to be making these decisions. Something he outlines, and I think it's his, I think I've got this right, his best-selling book is Basic Economics. You know, it was interesting at the beginning of this conversation, you're talking about your encounter with Sowell at a bookstore was this. You thought maybe he even designed the cover because there's nothing. There's very little flair to Thomas Sowell. It's just sort of straight, dry facts. I don't mean he's boring, but he's not trying to entertain necessarily. And Basic Economics is about as boring a title as I can think of. And it is a pretty dry book. It's a big book, but it is a incredible book in that it just explains a seemingly difficult conversation, economics, in a way that probably almost any high schooler could sit down and read it and get a quality education. And that is, and I'm getting a little off here. I guess I was saying he brings this knowledge problem into economics, right? He says that the part of the fallacy sometimes of the intellects is this, is the hubris that they can better understand the economic system, where in reality, it's each of us common men and women making decisions that can, on net, make wiser economic choices than a small pool of experts.
Correct. I agree with you 100%. That's a good reading of it.
Well, and it may be an unfair summary of it because it's a big book. He has a lot of arguments there. I know you did, for example, an entire podcast on his views on minimum wage. Again, not exactly the most flamboyant topic. But what was Sowell's main contention on minimum wage laws as to whether they are helpful or harmful? And by the way, I should mention, you mentioned going to a cafe to ask about the jury system. I really like that in your podcast. You just do sort of these man on the streets. You asked intellects, right? You went to a university where arguably some of the most intelligent among us congregate and just asked them those questions. What is your opinion on minimum wage laws? To which all but one individual had nothing but positive things to say about a minimum wage.
Yeah, I mean, in Basic Economics, Thomas Sowell talks about minimum wage laws and how they lead to unemployment. And they lead to teenage unemployment, especially, and they prevent teenagers from getting a very valuable job experience. And I could really relate to this because I started work. I was a stock boy in a pharmacy when I was 13, and I worked all throughout my high school time as an ice cream scooper, as a stock boy, as a lifeguard, every job you could possibly think of. And I gained tremendously valuable work experience and, had the minimum wage be set absurdly high, I doubt I could have been hired at the age of 13 or 14. Who would have wanted me? And it would have prevented me from getting some really valuable work experience. And Thomas Hill makes this argument, and he also argues that minimum wages lead to a lot of other disruptions in the economy. You know, it drives some companies out of business. And it creates, in general, just more unemployment than would be there without the minimum wage. So, and people have been debating this for a long time. And I had an economist on the podcast to come talk about it. And, you know, of course, he adds a ton of subtlety and nuance to the whole discussion and can really confuse you. And that's sort of what, you know, intellectuals are able to do through good arguments and study this and study that. But what I thought was the most interesting part about that episode was, you're right, I went to Caltech, which is probably one of the best universities in the world. So it's, you got to be really smart to get in there. And I stopped the first 20 people that I passed on the walkway. And I asked them, you know, what do you think about minimum wage laws? And 19 out of 20 thought they were a fantastic idea. And, you know, there's one fellow who had his doubts. He said, I think it causes unemployment. But no one else thought that. And when I mentioned that, they were like, huh, I never thought about that before. I don't know. Does it? I'd have to see a study. I'd have to see, you know, like they were really skeptical. Mm-hmm. And they approached the issue of minimum wages as an idea that sounds really good. You know, Sowell talks about that, you know, that some ideas just sound really good, even though they don't work, and people cling to them. And I think minimum wage was a great example of one of those ideas that just sound terrific. You know, people should make a living wage. They should make more money. That sounds fair to me. You know, if only reality were that simple, that only, you know, that all the ideas that sounded good really worked. Wouldn't that be a terrific world? And I think that's the point that Sowell's making, you know, in basic economics, in economic facts and fallacies, that there are a lot of ideas that sound great, but actually, you know, not only do they not work, but they actually cause the very problem they're trying to solve, which is, in this case, poverty.
Yeah, and I think it's a very Sowellian idea that many of our problems come from individuals trying to get the world to match the vision that's in their head. And it's very Sowellian to say, no, we need our visions to conform to reality, not the other way around.
Right.
You mentioned you had the guest on, and I listened to that episode. It was very good. You're right. The professor had a lot of subtlety and nuance in minimum wage. But part of at issue here, and one of my favorite Thomas Sowell quotes, and I'm not going to get this exact, but I'll just try to summarize, is he basically says, the first rule of economics is scarcity, that there's not enough to go around to satisfy everyone. The first rule of politics is to ignore the first rule of economics.
Right.
And it's obviously witty, but I think there's a lot of truth to that, because in listening to this nuanced argument of the economist you had on, that was what was going through my head for most of that conversation, was it may in fact be that there are ways in which we could institute certain limited nuanced minimum wage laws across the country that would, on net, be beneficial and actually address poverty. But I don't trust us in our fallen nature to find a way to work that through a political process, say, right? Most of what we hear from minimum wage arguments is $15 an hour across the nation. And on occasion, we'll get the nuance of maybe it should vary per state or region. But that is sometimes, I think, the limitations of intellectuals is it's not even sometimes that they're wrong. It's that they don't have the capacity to fully implement maybe the ideas they do have in a way that works with human nature.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Sowell often gives the example of, like, in the Soviet Union, the Central Politburo had to decide the prices of 20 million different goods and services on the market. And I mean, it sounds good in theory, you know, some supercomputer that could figure out what everything should cost and could update that, on a minute by minute basis. I mean, but in reality, I mean, could it ever really be done as well as the market does itself through individuals, you know, buying or not buying things that they want? And so I would say, no, it's not possible. This is not possible. However theoretically attractive it might sound, it's just not possible. And I mean, you can call it the fallen nature of human beings, or just our limitations in terms of the ability to integrate knowledge.
This conversation obviously is going to be a woeful summary of 9 decades of thought of Thomas Sowell, 47 books, just an immense amount of output. There's no way we could cover it. And so there's a lot of other directions and questions I could ask, but I want to, in wrapping up and closing here, because this is something I've heard you turn to a time or two on your show. What are your basic thoughts around why Thomas Sowell is not better read, better understood, and better known than what he actually is? I mean, as we were kind of talking about in the green room, just to lead into this, Thomas Sowell does have a lot of fanboys, a lot of them and I've not immersed myself fully in Thomas Sowell as much as I possibly should, but a lot of individuals who know him from little clips and videos, little memes, little quotes of his, which he can be very witty and very, very quippy. But it does seem that you have the view, one that I would share, that he's not as celebrated or as known or as read or as argued as what his immense genius would seem to suggest he ought to be. And I was wondering if you could speak to that and whether or not you had any thoughts as to why that might be.
So to answer your question, Josh, I'm going to read you a Thomas Sowell quote, and we could probably end with this quote. Quote, many issues are misconstrued, not because they are too complex for most people to understand, but because a mundane explanation is far less emotionally satisfying than an explanation which produces villains to hate and heroes to exalt, end quote. So I think one of the reasons why Sowell is not as popular as he should be is that his explanations don't leave you with angels and villains. They leave you with the complexity of human life and a sort of a neutral emotional charge about the ups and downs of human affairs. No heroes, no villains, just nuance and complexity. And that is not something that's emotionally satisfying to most people. Thomas Sowell often quotes Eric Hoffer. And the quote that I love the most is Hoffer would say, quote, "Many movements can function without a belief in a God, but no movement can function without believing in a devil." And I know when Sowell quotes that, he wishes he himself had said it, because I think it summarizes so much of the value of Thomas Sowell.
Hmm. And that certainly, sadly, runs against the grain of, I would say, what is the predominant approach to, say, political discourse in the United States, that we operate almost entirely emotively and need to seek out our villains and heroes. But it's such an unhealthy approach that I think wears you out. As one of the things I enjoy about Sowell's approach is I don't walk away emotionally charged, but I feel like I'm eating my broccoli, right? Like I'm a better person for having read it.
100%. 100%.
Well, Alan, as I said, we are not going to be able to probably give even a fair summary of the works of Thomas Sowell, but I want to thank you for not only taking the time to come on, but thank you for the podcast you produce, The Genius of Thomas Sowell. It's one that we probably needed a long time ago, but I'm grateful it's out there. I'm looking forward to what you produce in the future. And everyone, be sure and check out The Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Alan, thank you for taking the time to come on Saving Elephants.
It was my pleasure, Josh. It was fantastic to talk with you. Let's do it again.
I'm Alan Wolin, and this has been episode 13 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Thanks for listening.